The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan, Bill Cundiff, and
Bob Martin.
I had to be Aaron and Bill because Bill got stuck parking the car. Oh, he's back. We had to switch parking spaces. You know, you start in the yellow and it's all over but the ticketing. It's Sunday, though. Do they still ticket?
Not on Sundays.
Oh, darn it. Could have left it alone.
Not in our neck of the
woods. Here we were compelled to be, you know, law-abiding citizens.
Of course, you're familiar with the show Parking Wars, right?
No, but I think we were having it out front.
Well, that's based in one of the places it's based is Philadelphia.
Oh, well, our friends in Philadelphia then know what you're talking
they
about.
They know all about parking wars.
Well, here we go. Got Bill's computer up and running so he can join us. We have Hamid Azimi on the phone with us. We're actually much more organized than it sounds. And, you know, we hear so much about the Iran deal. And whether it's good or whether it's bad, and that all those guys are chanting death to America and blah, blah, blah. And I got an email the other day that was from the Iranian American community of Northern California. And as I read through it, I thought, hey, wait a minute. These guys sound like people that they sound like us. And, you know, you always know you're not getting the full story, but I really wanted somebody to tell us the story who could give us an unbiased view and give us a look at this deal that we keep hearing about, although much of it is secret. So we're not necessarily going to talk about the Iran deal, but we're going to talk about what's going on in their country and lots of things that I'll bet you most people didn't know. So, Hamid, I'm going to let you tell people what you would like them to know. I've listed your Facebook page, your Twitter page, that you are a human rights activist, and a secular republic is at reach, and we need to give the Ayatollahs the last push to get rid of them. I love that part. I put that right on the top. And links to your events, I guess we should bring that up too. We'll talk more about those, but they have a rally in New York, September 28th, so that's coming up in a few days, and in Berkeley. This group is actually based out of Berkeley. On August 29th at 6 o'clock, you can hear the untold story of the 1988 massacre by the Iranian regime. So they spend a lot of time killing their own guys, and there are tons of people in Iran opposing this leadership that don't want to go to war with us. So I guess that's like the quick snippet of what we're going to chat about. And then those are all the details I know, so now I'll stop talking. All right, Hamid, where would you like to start?
Good afternoon to you, Aaron and Bill, and to Bob and to all of your listeners. I sincerely appreciate you providing me this time so that I can talk about Iran and human rights in Iran and what the Iran deal is going to mean for all of us, to you and your listeners. So as you mentioned, I am a member and communications director for the Iranian American Community of Northern California. As it has been stated on our website and documentation for many, many years now, we are a group of Iranians that want to be the voice of the oppressed people of Iran here in the United States. We want to be their voice here. And what we are after, as you so clearly mentioned, is a secular republic in which we are going to abide with all international laws and norms, all the covenants that have been approved by the United Nations for human rights, women's rights, minority rights. We are against death penalty, and in such we are with no doubt against all of the policies of or all of the executions that are going on in Iran right now. As you and I talked earlier on the phone for a little while, and I mentioned to you about the abysmal situation of human rights in Iran and the last three decades that our nation has been at war with our government, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Ayatollah's regime, which is no republic, no Islamic, nothing. It's just a clear religious dictatorship that is getting its guidelines from many centuries ago and has no place in common history and the current history that we live in. This regime, over the last 30 years, has executed over 120,000 political prisoners. I'll repeat that, 120,000.
Oh, my gosh. Who qualifies to be executed? What do you have to do? You know,
anything starting from 30 years ago, Aaron, anything that had any signs of opposition to the religious dictatorship that considers itself the arm of God on earth and it considers itself the messenger of God and whatever they say and do is the rule of what God wants on earth. And that is what they use as the basis of anything that and anyone that opposes them. They have the term of calling them enemy of God on earth, which requires no trial, no jury, and the punishment is execution. And anybody who opposes the supreme leader and doubts the leadership of the supreme leader, which was Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the person who actually started the religious dictatorship in Iran after the fall of Shah, and now his successor, Khamenei, who is the person who has been behind all of the policies, including the Iran deal right now. Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. What is the percentage of people that are in Iran that oppose this government? I mean, are you a small faction, or is it the majority of people over there that are just afraid to speak out?
It is absolutely the majority. Now, keep in mind that you're talking about a religious dictatorship that has more than three people hanging every day the last couple of years that this Rouhani has been placed in the president. So we cannot have any open polls or such, but there are quite a lot of indications in terms of the rallies that take place. And again, keep in mind that when you have a state of terror going on, for each person that makes it to the street and chants death to the dictator, there are thousands who are afraid to come out. What we saw as the clear popular indication of what the people want was in 2008, where we had the massive uprisings in the street of Tehran and other cities in Iran, where thousands upon thousands of people came out and they started requesting change and they wanted to make sure that we have freedom and democracy instead of the religious dictatorship. And ironically, it was in the same time that people wanted to make sure that they get some external support, not in terms of military or any type of military action in Iran, but simply hearing that the world leaders are actually supporting the cause of Iranian resistance. And there are video clips on YouTube that you can hear people chanting in the streets of Tehran, "Obama, are you with them?" meaning the Ayatollahs, "or with us?" The chant is in Persian, "Obama, Obama, Ya Ba Una, Ya Ba Ma," which translates basically, "you're either with them, the Ayatollahs, or with us." So in that term, there was clear indication that there still is, although unreported in the mainstream media, that there are ongoing rallies, demonstrations, in different cities of Iran in different parts. And the majority of the people of Iran, which are under the age of 30, are Iran is a very young population, has a very young population. They do want democratic change. They do want to be able to have freedom of choice, freedom of expression, and be able to use internet for example, freely.
And we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I just want a clarification. Aren't the people that are wanting change now the same folks that tossed out the Shah and wanted the Ayatollah to come back? I'm a little confused on that part, but we're going to take a quick break.
So we have to go back a little further. See, I told you we were going to do a lot of history because because we need
it. Sounds good to me.
Because we need it. I thought that your point was well made. 75%, I think I read on your website, 75% of the people in your country are under the age of 30?
That's correct.
Yeah, I guess when you keep killing everyone, the population gets younger and younger. That is, anyway, I'm excited to learn the rest of the story. We're going to take a quick break. Rejoin us in 2 minutes with Hamid Azimi. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Tons of information there for you. Be right back. Name of the game. Everybody wants to rule the world. And if you can't rule the world, what the heck? Just beat up on your own people. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. You can find all our archives for the last, I don't know, back to 2010. We've got shows on almost everything. If you have ideas for programs, our emails and phone numbers and stuff are on there. And we'd love to get your ideas. All right, so we're on with Hamid Azimi. All right, Hamid, explain to us how we got from the Shah to this and who was in majority. We were talking in the chat room here just during the break that your country lost an entire generation of people during the Iran-Iraq war. So that explains.
That is definitely true. And let me just step back and explain that the Iranian people have had a history of wanting to achieve democratic stage for the last over 100 years. About 100 years ago, we had our constitutional movement in Iran that wanted to move the monarchy from whatever stage it was to a constitutional government. And then in 1950s, pardon me, we had the movement in Iran led by Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister of the Shah, that nationalized the Iranian oil industry. And he was a person that wanted to have democracy in Iran and wanted to change the form of the government. And unfortunately, his government was toppled by a CIA-backed coup d'etat in Iran. And later on, during Clinton years, the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, offered the people of Iran an apology, which was, in my opinion, way too little and way too late. By the time we got into 1970s, I was a student in Iran, and I remember vividly the night that President Carter was visiting Tehran and talking to the Shah of Iran. He was referring to his monarchy and what he was doing as the island of stability in the Middle East. That's what President Carter, how he described the Iranian regime situation under the Shah in 1978. Less than 2 years after that, I believe it was 13, 14 months after that, our society has risen up against the Shah to the level that the Shah had to leave the country, and we had the change of regime in 1979. What ended up happening after that was basically the religious leaders in Iran, led by Khomeini, they hijacked our revolution. They hijacked our people's revolution that wanted to achieve democracy in Iran. We wanted a secular democracy. We wanted to be part of the international community. We wanted to have an end to the social injustices that were going on under the Shah. We wanted to end the police state that the Shah was using to rule the country. And we wanted to have all type of freedoms that everybody else in the civilized world was enjoying. Unfortunately, because of the situation of progressive political groups in Iran, which were all imprisoned by the Shah. And because of that, they did not have the type of presence that they needed to have in the society to lead the revolution in the right direction. The religious leaders, who were very strong in Iran, stole our revolution and established, after less than 2 years, what they call the Islamic Republic of Iran, with the goal of establishing the Islamic Caliph in the Middle East, the Islamic State, basically. So what Khomeini wanted to do after stealing our revolution was basically materializing what his type had wanted for centuries, which was Islamic State. And the Islamic State that they wanted to have was with the clear slogan that they wanted to spread the type of Islamic rule that they envisioned throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. And that is what was the inception of all of the export of fundamentalism that the Iranian regime started doing into Iraq, all the way to Syria and Lebanon, and from the other side to, you know, other countries in the Middle East and into North Africa and what have you. So in that term, all of these things that have been happening have been in the direct contrast and contradiction and conflict with what the Iranian people have desired. When I was talking about the uprising of 2008, that was again the voice of the Iranian people wanting to tell the world that this is not what we want. We want to get rid of these ayatollahs, and we want to establish democracy and freedom and secularism in our homeland.
So would it be safe to assume the folks that led the uprising in 79 and had their uprising hijacked by the Ayatollah, most of them are probably dead from the Iran-Iraq war? Would that be correct?
Quite a lot of them, unfortunately, did get killed in that war. There is not a single family in Iran that has not had somebody killed in that war, including my own family, where I lost a cousin, and other members of my family were injured in that war. And other than, you know, what was the result or the casualties of that war, what is really important, Bill, is for us to realize that the reason that war got started was because of what Ayatollah Khomeini was doing in terms of exporting his vision of Islamic State into Iraq. Back then, Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq as a Sunni, and as, you know, a lot of people even say that he was not enforcing any type of religion in his rule. But Ayatollah Khomeini was banking on the fact that the Shia population in Iraq were ready to uprise against Saddam Hussein. So he was actually meddling in the affairs of the Iraqis and sending messages to the Iraqi Shia back then. Now I'm talking about, you know, this was in 1980 and 82, between 80 and 82. And so he was trying to establish his foothold and footstep in Iraq with the Shia population so that he can continue his path of exporting his brand of Islam into Jordan and Syria and Lebanon. And if you, you know, these countries that I am naming is basically, if you look at the map of the Middle East, from Iran to the left, you cross to Iraq, and then after that is Jordan, and then you have the clutter of Syria and Lebanon, and right in the left corner, Palestine and Israel with their conflict there. And the Iranian regime basically wanted to start from Iraq as the footstep that had the majority Shia population and move on and spread their terror into Lebanon and Syria. And unfortunately, they had a lot of success in doing that because the civilized world did not realize that this is what they are doing and this is what they are trying to achieve. And voices, you know, like mine over the last 30 years were not loud enough to alarm the people that needed to be alarmed, or the people who needed to be alarmed did not listen to the proper advice and did not do what they were supposed to do.
So I guess you could say, or is it correct to say, that as bad as Saddam Hussein was, he kind of kept a lid on the whole Islamic State movement?
I'm really not familiar with the details of how he was ruling his country, but what I can tell you with 100% confidence is that the Islamic State, in terms of what Khomeini started in Iran, had a lid on it because there was no place for it to flourish and spread. Now, after the 79 revolution, and because it was stolen by the Ayatollahs, we had a country like Iran with the very important geopolitical situation that it has, right, you know, about the Persian Gulf, with the majority of the oil for the entire world passing through the Strait of Hormuz right next door, controlled by Iran as a country. This country, you know, to the right of Iraq, to the left of Afghanistan, with conflicts that international community was involved in, this country ended up having a government that was spreading Islamic fundamentalism. State sponsorship of fundamentalism and terror was the biggest outcome of the hijacking of our revolution. We had a very strong country with a lot of resources, a lot of oil money, as a government sponsoring Islamic terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism throughout the region. That was the turning point that is still going on, and the world needs to realize that this is the fundamentally huge mistake that the world made in not realizing that this was a huge danger, and supporting the people of Iran to uproot these people and get rid of the Ayatollahs should have been and must be right now the main policy of the West.
Okay.
Yeah, see, there just is, there's quite a bit that we obviously don't hear.
No, we just don't. We just don't get it in our media. I mean,
no, we don't. And there's just so much going on. That's the thing.
Everybody's well, a lot of it too is the fact that you can't get news out of Iran. I mean, they have a pretty good lock on what comes out of there, don't they? I mean, we don't get to hear the other side.
Well, that's how you know. I mean, that's the number one job of a dictator, isn't it? Cut off communication.
And make
sure nobody can support you too, because if nobody can support you, well, you'll get hijacked or killed or just bottom line fail again. We need to take another really quick break. We are speaking with Hamid Azimi. He is the communications director of the Iranian American Community of Northern California, and so we're getting a story. I don't mean a make-believe story, but I mean we're telling the tale of what's really going on in Iran, the things that we don't see. And for the people that are panicking, thinking, are you guys supporting the Iran deal that's on the table now? Is that one guy in the chat room said, is that where you're going? It's like, no, that's not where we're going. So, sorry, spoiler alert, we're not going to the support of the Iran deal. But we'll explain to you why that is. We thought why was more important than a yes or no answer. Besides that, yes or no doesn't take 2 hours, and why does. So we'll be right back with you. Lots of information on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. That's kind of scary. Okay, because that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, I've got a. Whoops, am I there? There we go.
There you are.
I've got a question. They're talking in the chat about the difference between the Arab population and the Persian population in Iran, and are Iranians Arabs or Persians?
Well, because see, it says in the chat. Iranian is a made-up name by Arab invaders. It's like, aha. Okay, can you, demystify that for us, Hamid?
Well,
we're much dumber than you thought. You got to go back a long way.
Persia and Persian and how it turned to Iran does have a history, and I know there's a valid discussion there. But in the general concept of what the question Bill asked, Persians are not of Arab descent, so the language is different, the culture is different, and our background is from the era of the Zoroastrians in Iran more than 2,000 years ago, and the monarchies in Iran, starting with Cyrus the Great 2,500 years ago, started a nation in the Middle East that was from the get-go in favor of human rights and democracy. And a lot of listeners might not know that in the United Nations there is a little stroll of Cyrus the Great. It's a little clay stroll that is kept at UN, I believe. I believe it's there, and it is the first declaration of human rights in history made by the Persian Emperor Cyrus the Great.
And now and was he Arab?
No. When we go back that many years in history, you know, the nationalities and where people came from was totally different. But right now, I'm just trying to explain to the listeners with the little historical, expertise that I have that the Persians are from the era of, Cyrus the Great that established a monarchy in Iran, and the language was Parsi, which was not Arabic. It's, the roots of the languages are the same. If you can think about it, like, English and Spanish and French, that the roots are the same. Latin, the alphabets are the same, but throughout the history, the right now in our continent, the Spanish speaking and English speaking are of totally different, background because of the history that they have carried over. It's pretty much the same between Persians and Arabs, and, we have lived the countries that have been Arab speaking and Persian speaking, the main one, Iran, and part of Afghanistan. We have lived, alongside each other for many years, but how we identify ourselves is as Persian-speaking people and the people who are very proud of our cultural heritage, and to be very specific, in Iran, even after, what Ayatollahs are trying to do, our Nowruz celebration, which is the beginning of the new year. We celebrate the vernal equinox, the exact moment that the earth turns over and spring starts, as the beginning of our new year, which falls around March 20th, 21st, obviously based on the exact timing of the rotation of Earth. And that is the biggest celebration in Iran, and no matter what Ayatollahs tried to do to get people not to celebrate it, they did not succeed, and that celebration remains the major celebration for Iranians in Iran and all over the world. And that has no religious connotation or religious root. It's an absolutely 100% cultural event for Iranians going back to 2,000 years ago with Zoroastrians in Iran, which predates Islam by, I believe, 1.5 centuries.
Yeah.
So actually, 1.5 millennium, I should say, yeah. 1,500 years or so. So that is how we identify ourselves. Persians who are very, keen of our culture and our language, and we are not Arabic speaking. We do not necessarily celebrate any of the religious ceremonies or religious, days that are celebrated as, Muslims or Christians, even though even Christmas is celebrated by a lot of Iranians as we honor it. Other Muslim holidays like the birth of the Prophet is celebrated and we honor it, but again, we do not identify as a nation by any of those. We respect them, but what we do identify ourselves by as Persians who celebrate Nowruz, the beginning of spring.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Much like the United States, we are a Christian culture, but we're made up of many different religions.
You can be an American, but be a
you could be
Catholic, Jewish, whatever.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Absolutely. So, back to our discussion about what is going on in Iran right now. As I mentioned, we are dealing with a government that has over the last 30 years executed 120,000 people, and 30,000 of these people were massacred in the summer of 1988, and that is one of the main subjects of our program that is coming up this Saturday. We will be talking about that massacre of 30,000 people. We will have among us people who have survived that massacre. One of our speakers was among people who was in prison the last few months of, you know, that massacre. She was arrested when she was 15 years old in Tehran for supporting the main opposition group, Ayatollahs, which is a organization called People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran. She was arrested for supporting PMOI, People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, and she was given a sentence of 5 years, ended up being in prison for 8, and witnessing, you know, what happened in prisons and how a massive number of people were executed in that summer.
Can you and give us a little snippet of what precipitated that? What, you know, what brought all that on in 88?
Absolutely. It was ironically toward the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And, you know, Khomeini's regime, Ayatollah's regime, had started that war and wanted to take over Iraq and make it a footstep for their Islamic State that they wanted to build. And because of different factors, including the fact that, you know, they had to deal with the mainstream opposition group that was gaining momentum, and, you know, no matter how many people the Ayatollahs imprisoned and killed, the opposition group, the PMOI, was gaining strength, and the Ayatollahs realized that they are not going to be able to fight in both fronts, internally and externally, and they were losing momentum in the war against Iraq, and the UN resolutions were coming one after the other asking for a ceasefire. So at a point, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the supreme leader back there, decided that he is going to eliminate all of his enemies internally in prison, and then end the war and, you know, have international pressure lifted from him, and at the same time, you know, eliminate his opposition. So in the last few months leading to where the Ayatollah accepted the UN ceasefire and ended the war, We have a lot of witnesses, including our speaker, that will attest that there was a movement within the prison system in Iran to eliminate all of the people who were steadfast in opposing the Ayatollahs. So he was basically gathering everybody, setting the stage to start the killing. And it was a very, you know, fast and quick process that the Ayatollahs were going through. They were basically just getting a panel of three judges and bring the prisoner in and ask them one simple question. Are you still a supporter of the PMOI, and are you going to stay that way? And if the answer was yes, I'm doing that, then the penalty was execution, and it was carried out very quickly. And there are a number of writings by Khomeini himself that suggest to these judges that they should carry out the sentence in the quickest way possible and do not be afraid of any reprisal, and just do what is supposed to be done. And it was in that era, in that atmosphere, and in that environment that the Ayatollah regime decided to get rid of all of these prisoners and it was, again, very ironic that it was under an international pressure that they gave in to the will of international community and the opposition groups that were working against them to stop a war. So they immediately, you know, started killing opposition in Iran. And unfortunately, that's what we are seeing right now, that as they are giving in to the international pressure, the number of executions in Iran is going up to the point that the last few weeks, Amnesty International has basically called it an unprecedented spike in executions. And the UN Special Human Rights Rapporteur to Iran has also, in his last report, said that, you know, the trend of and the situation, the human rights situation, has worsened in Iran. So, just finishing up the answer to your question, that was basically the setup that the Ayatollahs wanted to get rid of the opposition. The stage was set after accepting the ceasefire, and then they went ahead and they killed a massive number of people in the tune of 30,000 and more in prisons in Iran.
Wow. You know, nothing like letting everybody have their say. Good grief. If you take them all out, I guess they can't oppose you. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. People don't, they don't stay down forever. And we need to chat more about your opposition, because it's led by a woman. And so for those people that think that, I don't know, I mean, that was news to me. And a lot of people don't think women have any rights. Well, you have an entire opposition movement run by a lady. And on the website, you can see the video. There's a great video of her with Rudy Giuliani and a bunch of people from former congressmen and senators. So there are people in this country who know about it. They just don't wind up on the front page of the news. We're going to come right back with Hamid Azimi. We are going to speak with him the second hour as well. So we'll have just a few minutes when we come back this hour, but we hope you'll hang out with us. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. Stand a little taller. Doesn't mean I'm lonely when I'm alone. What doesn't kill you, makes you brighter. What does keep you lighter? Doesn't mean I'm over, 'cause you're gone. What doesn't kill you, makes you stronger.
Kind of a good song for that. Okay, so Hamid, we've just got a couple minutes here to the top of the hour, but what happened after the people were all executed? Do they have such a tight control on communication? Is that why we don't hear much of what happens?
Yeah, was there an uprising at that point? I would think that the population would have revolted.
Well, the population, you know, as you go through changes in your struggle as your enemy, which in our case is Ayatollahs, takes an action and takes out a lot of people in terms of executing them. The reason they do it is they want to have a atmosphere of fear and intimidation ruling the country. And obviously at different times they succeed to have that atmosphere prevail what is being done in the country. But
sure,
because of the nature of our nation, because of, as I mentioned, the fact that we have a history of more than 100 years of struggle to achieve this democracy, and because, as you mentioned, Erin, we do have an organized resistance led by a woman, Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, they really did not succeed in, you know, putting all of the fires down. The biggest fire that is burning is the leadership of a woman fighting the Islamic fundamentalists. Now, keep in mind that when you are fighting an entity, you got to realize what is the biggest element that defines and describes this entity. In terms of the Ayatollahs and the Islamic fundamentalists, their objection to freedom of woman is their biggest identifier. More than anything, they are against women's freedom. More than anything, they want to put down women.
Hold that thought, Hamid. Sorry, we were tardy on our breaks and we got jammed up here at the end. We will start fresh at 5 after, and we'll start on that point, because that's a big one, and that's a story we haven't been told. We're here with Hamid Azimi, the communications director of the Iranian American Community of Northern California. They've got events in New York on the 28th, September 28th, and here in California, August the 29th. So anyway, that's all online, wethepeopleradio.us.